It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. We'll talk about Hillary Clinton's apology last night for using a private email account while at the State Department.
First, Milwaukee Area Technical College announced a plan today that would offer free tuition to low-income, academically qualified high school seniors. The plan is known as the MATC Promise, and the college is calling it a game changer for families who otherwise couldn't afford to send their kids to college.
That plan would start next fall. In addition to helping students, there's hope that it would boost enrollment numbers at MATC, a problem that's been facing the college for some years now.
Joining us now to talk more about that plan is Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Karen, how significant a move is this for students in the Milwaukee area?
Well, considering that 83% of students in Milwaukee public schools are identified as low income, these are students who would meet the household income requirements for this program. It's potentially significant, but it's not a slam dunk. It's not just, oh, give me tuition and I'll go to college and that's all that's expected of me. There's some pretty strict requirements for both eligibility and then the commitment that students have to make once they get there.
So what are those commitments and other things they have to meet in terms of eligibility?
Okay, these are basically things that one would expect a high school senior to do if they're serious about attending college. So in this case, this is beginning with the class of 2016. So they're only looking at senior year grade point average. So if you have a GPA of 2.0 or higher your senior year, you're eligible. You have to have an attendance rate of 90%. You have to complete an application for federal student aid by the deadline. You have to apply for admission to MATC by December 1st. And then once you get there, you have to go full-time for four consecutive semesters. You can't drop out and then come back in. And the other interesting component, this is privately funded, by the way. This is not taxpayer dollars. The other interesting thing is that there is a requirement that students participate in service learning projects. So they have to give back 8 hours a semester to the community.
Now, you mentioned that there was the hope that this move could raise enrollment at Milwaukee Area Technical College. What do we know otherwise about why this was decided upon now?
Well, one of the things is MATC, like a lot of other technical colleges, did really well with their enrollment during the recession. You had displaced workers who went back to school to try to reinvent themselves. This is a lower-cost alternative than a four-year degree. And so their enrollment was starting to decline once working adults, and non-traditional students returned to the workforce. There's also a big move, a big push nationally. President Obama has called for free tuition, 2 years of free tuition for students. I believe Hillary Clinton has a platform on that. It's the whole notion of a two-year commitment for free college for students who qualify has become a big thing on the national scene.
And it sounds as though this has been tried elsewhere. What do we know about how it's fared in other parts of the country?
Well, I spoke with a couple of individuals from Tennessee. Tennessee started something called the Tennessee Achieve Program in 2008, so they have a pretty good track record with this. And I was curious what their retention rate was like, whether they had trouble keeping students in the four consecutive semesters, whether students fulfilled the requirement for service, and that kind of thing. And what I found out was that a lot of students wait till the very last minute to do their public service, community service projects. Retention rate was about 33% that's the three-year graduation rate. It was about 33%. Retention rate from year to year was about 69%.
Not bad.
Gotcha.
We're talking with Karen Herzog right now, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's joining us to talk about Milwaukee Area Technical College's plan to offer free tuition to low-income students. And Karen, you mentioned that this is private money. This is not taxpayer money. How is MATC funding this and funding it in the future as well?
The MATC Foundation, which has existed, I believe, since 1997. It hasn't always been around. But the MATC Foundation is about to launch a $1 million campaign for scholarships. This is something that MITC President Vicki Martin had wanted to do from the time she took the job a year ago. She's been at MITC for many years, worked in student services. This is something that she saw as a great need to help students get through school. And so this was something that she brought to the foundation, the MITC Foundation, after hearing about the Tennessee Promise at a conference. I believe it was in April. So she heard about this. She heard that it worked elsewhere, and she thought, well, we can do this too. So it's been something that they've turned around pretty quickly, and the fundraising is just beginning. They figure they need about $350,000 for the first year of this program, and obviously additional money to continue it into the future.
Now, this program is set to launch next fall. How is MITC going to get the word out and work with area high schools so that students know about the options that are now going to be available?
Well, they are working closely with MPS, Milwaukee Public Schools, and that's a really important partnership because obviously there are lots of deadlines for students to meet. They can't just put their name in the hat and say, okay, I'm going. So the schools have to kind of work with them and help them and their parents in areas such as filling out the financial aid form. It's very complicated. You know, it requires a lot of information. So MITC is going to be doing some workshops on that. And the partnership between MITC and MPS and, frankly, all the other schools in the area and MITC's service area where their students are able to take advantage of this program, that partnership's really important.
And does MITC then plan to add a lot of staff, maybe in the early years, so that they can support some of these students and the needs that this program requires?
That's a great question. I wondered about that, too, what their capacity was to add students like this. And I was told that they probably will have to expand staff in areas of financial aid and admissions to give a little extra special attention to these students. Also, I wondered about whether they would have to have recruiters, more recruiters going into schools. And that part wasn't really clear, but they do expect that they will probably have to expand to some degree. They expect to net about 1,000 new students through the MITC Promise in the first year, but they said they could accommodate up to 3,500 new students through this program.
Now, this is free tuition, but what is not covered in the plan?
Well, it should be really the clear commitment is that the college pays the difference between federal and state financial aid grants. So it's not like all of it, you know, like that MITC is forgiving tuition. It's basically we'll make up the difference between your financial aid and the cost. Books are not covered. Just tuition and fees are covered, so books wouldn't be covered. Transportation back and forth to school wouldn't be covered. Living expenses wouldn't be covered, that kind of thing. And those are big, big hurdles for many students to be able to attend college.
Now, it sounds like the MITC Promise is part of a bigger campaign that's being launched by the MITC Foundation. What else is that campaign looking to do?
Well, they're trying to increase the amount of money that's available for scholarships campus-wide for students who are currently enrolled. And federal financial aid does cover, you know, some because obviously these are students who tend to be from lower-income families. But there's always a gap. There's always, you know, the part that the family is expected to contribute. In this case, a family of four with an income of $35,000 to $38,000 will qualify for that program. And that's the typical student at MATC. So if their parents or they don't have $3,000 to contribute toward their education, then there's a big gap there that has to be filled.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about Milwaukee Area Technical College's plan to offer free tuition to low-income students.
Hillary Clinton apologized last night, said she made a mistake when she used a personal email account for state business as Secretary of State.
But in retrospect, certainly, as I look back at it now, even though it was allowed, I should have used two accounts, one for personal, one for work-related emails. That was a mistake. I'm sorry about that. I take responsibility. And I'm trying to be as transparent as I possibly can to not only release 55,000 pages of my emails, turn over my server, but I am looking forward, finally, to testifying before Congress.
Hillary Clinton there. It's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. On the campaign trail, Ben Carson has surged to second in Iowa, just behind Donald Trump, and Democrats are still waiting to see if Vice President Joe Biden will run.
And Congress is back in session as of yesterday, beginning the countdown to the end of the month when the government's funding will run out. Our regular guest, Harry Enten, is out today. Here with us, though, is Central Time veteran Paul Singer. He is USA Today's Washington correspondent. Good to have you back, Paul.
Great to be back with you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Hillary Clinton. She's been not quite apologizing or saying she made a mistake up until this new interview. Does this change anything?
I'm not sure it does. Part of the problem, I think, for the Clinton campaign is that the story just continues to dribble and drab out. And it's one of those things where if she had started this conversation 3 months ago by saying, you know, this was a bad idea, I'm sorry, we shouldn't have done it this way, you know, how can we help make this right, it would have basically taken away a lot of the steam for this story. Instead, she has been saying all along, well, you know, we didn't do anything wrong, and we're trying to, you know, be transparent, and yet new things keep appearing on the story every couple of days, and it just dogs them. They can't seem to shake this story, and I'm not sure this helps all that much.
And there had been criticism and frustration expressed by her fellow Democrats that she hadn't taken this more seriously and done so sooner.
Yeah, you know, crisis management 101 is get it all out there, get ahead of the story, and don't leave more. Make it into a one-day story, as it were. Now, this is probably never going to be a one-day story because she's running for president, but I think they probably could have done much more from a crisis management standpoint about getting ahead of this story instead of always being behind it.
Now, you mentioned this apology doesn't mark the end of it. Could it actually have more damage now since it's been festering for a while and reignite criticism of her?
I don't know. I mean, I think the issue at this point is obviously they keep producing batches of emails out of the State Department. If anything in there ends up being incendiary, thus far none of them have been, then, you know, that reignites the story. And then, of course, the we're waiting for her October testimony before the Benghazi committee. That will be the next great moment in this tale, I believe, when she'll have an opportunity to defend herself in a public forum, and she'll be Republicans have an opportunity to put her on the spot in a public forum.
Let's turn to Republicans now. The rest of the race, USA Today, your place of operation, released its second week of GOP power rankings for presidential candidates. Big jump for Carly Fiorina.
Yeah.
First, tell us about these power rankings. How do you get there?
Well, we make it up.
Dartboard.
Yeah, right. We got 30 smart people, and we asked them to weigh in every week, sort of like the coaches poll in college football. We just asked experts, who do you think is the strongest candidate this week? And each week they've been giving us responses. It's really interesting. We've been very vague about what we mean by strongest. We've let them sort of determine what they think the strongest candidate is each week. And indeed, Donald Trump and Ben Carson have been at the top of this. This outsider movement is really apparently taking hold in the Republican Party. And then this week, our experts, panel of experts, said that Carly Fiorina has really leapt to the forefront, in part because her inclusion in the CNN main stage debate next week suddenly puts her amongst the top tier of candidates and gives her a chance to prove that she belongs there.
Right, and she had a big jump in polling and just general respect, I think, based on her pre-debate performance, the also-rans, if you will, debate. That's part of what got her into the main stage now. Is this translating into things like polling support? Are more people taking her seriously?
Yeah, I mean, you see her numbers rising. I mean, again, she's not leaping up into the 20% support range where you'll find Donald Trump and possibly Ben Carson. But she is, up into the top tier, as it were. If she's taking, 4 or 5 or 6 or 7% in a poll, that's enough to make you top tier when you've got 17 candidates in the field. I think this is the kind of moment in a campaign where she has gotten an entree to make her case. Now, let's see how she does in the debate next week and whether she can cement that position. If nothing else, As the only woman in the field, she's distinctive, and I think that plays to her credit.
You mentioned Ben Carson a couple times there, number two in your power ranking behind Donald Trump. Trump obviously getting a lot of attention. Ben Carson maybe not getting as much media attention. Well, nobody's getting as much as Trump, I guess. Why is Ben Carson doing so well?
You know, what people have said about Carson is that he is doing a terrific job of offering a very reasoned, or that is to say, less combative and less bellicose version of a true conservative vision than Donald Trump. So whereas Trump is flashy and loud and in your face, Carson is none of those things. He's very measured. He's kind of quiet. And people have really responded well, particularly in Iowa. We're finding the religious conservatives there, who make up a big part of the caucus voters, have really responded well to Dr. Carson, and that's really propelled him in the polls.
Before we move on to power rankings, if I can make an NFL analogy, yeah. You can't base too much on what happened in the preseason.
That's right.
This is preseason,
That's right.
A lot could change.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're trying to be very clear with the people that, you know, none of this matters until somebody casts a vote. And at the moment, no one's casting a vote. However, I do believe it is true that if you troll at the bottom of the polls for too long, you just stop being able to raise any money, and then your campaign just sort of runs out of gas. I think that's the danger that someone like Rick Perry is facing right now.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today on our weekly look at national politics, a touchy issue for candidates, this Kentucky story, the Round County clerk just out of jail now over a refusal to administer same-sex marriage licenses. How are candidates, Republican candidates in particular, responding to that?
Well, you know, Mike Huckabee was sort of at the forefront of standing, literally standing next to her as she was released from jail. This is sort of a sweet spot for Huckabee with the religious conservative voters. That's where Huckabee really lives in this field. You know, he's sort of proud to stand there. Ted Cruz was also at that event. There's a little bit, possibly a bit of a tiff between Huckabee and Cruz over who is the real religious conservative here, but nevertheless. And then in sort of, you know, descending order, the other candidates, proclaimed her right to her position. I think for the Republicans in this race, the issue becomes one of religious liberty. They're trying to make this a religious liberty argument that you need to have the right to practice your faith and that the court shouldn't steamroll that. The opposition, of course, says, yes, but gays have a right to be married, and you shouldn't be able to sit in a government position and say they can't once the Supreme Court says they can.
Let's move into Congress. And, Paul, it seems like old times. There's a funding deadline and talk of a shutdown. I've uttered that sentence to you many times over the last couple of years, I think. Give us the latest.
Run tape of a previous
show.
Yeah,
exactly. Take a break now. But this time, a little different cause now, Planned Parenthood funding.
To be clear, there is at the heart of this a dispute about funding levels, and you know, Republicans are going to want more money for the Defense Department, and Democrats are going to want more money for some of the domestic programs. So there is still a real battle there. But the fear now is that Planned Parenthood funding is going to be the sticking point. Ultimately, they have until September 30th to do something to make sure the government doesn't run out of money. And a bunch of the conservatives, Republican conservatives primarily, are bucking for a sentence that would bar Planned Parenthood from getting any federal funding. This is based on these videos that have been, undercover videos that have been released, suggesting that Planned Parenthood might have been, or some people at Planned Parenthood might have been, discussing selling tissue from abortions. Planned Parenthood, of course, completely denied that was the case. We'll see. I mean, it's not clear how you solve this because there's no real negotiation. You either do fund or don't fund Planned Parenthood. And if you have 30 or 40 conservative Republicans saying we are not going to vote for this bill unless it defunds Planned Parenthood, then you got to get some Democrats to support the bill. And so what do you got to give them? That becomes a very difficult dance for particularly Republican Speaker John Boehner.
Absent that Planned Parenthood issue, would anybody be talking shutdown in this time around?
Well, probably not, although, you know, there would be some other issues that would pop up, whether it's the export-import bank that people are concerned about. You know, some people want to shut down just because it makes for good theater. Somebody said to me the other day, you know, the Republicans no longer have 54 members in the Senate. They have 50 members in the Senate plus four guys running for president, and who knows where they're going to be on any of these issues.
Right. That adds a wrinkle to this. They are looking over their shoulder at early primary voters who are watching their behavior on an issue like this.
That's right. And it makes it a little more complicated for the Republican leadership because they can't just expect fealty to the party when you ultimately have to make some sort of splash in a presidential campaign. So it's going to be interesting, but I honestly don't know how this plays out. But the threat of a shutdown seems as real as it has seemed in the past couple of years. So we'll see.
A common outcome, a temporary push it down the road kind of solution. Is that a likely outcome this time?
Yeah, well, that's what they'll, I mean, I think the Republican leadership is going to try to get to, is if they can get a 2 or 3 month extension, and then they can have a little more time to fight this out. I mean, I mentioned in one of my stories this week that the last time Congress actually passed all of its appropriations bills by the end of the fiscal year, that is, you know, September 30th, was 1997. Like every year we do this, we get to a point where they can't actually fund the government, they need a little more time, they extend a little while, and then they throw all these bills, 12 separate appropriations bills, into one giant mess, an omnibus bill with who knows what in it, we find out 6 months later.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Great to talk to you again.
That was USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. We cover the latest in national politics every week at this time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. According to new data from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, abortions performed in Wisconsin were down 10% in 2014. It's the sixth year in a row that abortions have declined in the state.
This summer, Governor Walker signed legislation making abortions after the 20-week mark illegal, with no exceptions for rape or incest. And in 2013, the governor put the final signature on a law that would require women seeking an abortion to undergo an ultrasound first and ban doctors from performing abortions if they didn't have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. The latest data from Wisconsin comes amid an effort to block federal funding from Planned Parenthood here in the state.
Joining us now to look at possible reasons for the shift in abortion numbers in Wisconsin are Nicole Safar, Government Relations Director for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin. Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Chelsea Shields is with us. She's the Legislative PAC Director for Wisconsin Right to Life. Chelsea, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And Chelsea, we've got these new numbers out. Abortions performed in the state of Wisconsin are down 10%. And this comes after six back-to-back years where that number has fallen. Why do you think that number is consistently declining?
Well, I think a lot goes to pro-life legislation that has been passed over the years and also just overall education with the Right to Life movement, you know, showing women information about their unborn child, giving women more opportunities to see their unborn children on ultrasound, and that's really contributed quite a bit to this decrease in abortion numbers.
And Nicole, I want to go to you next. When you see these numbers and the trend of falling abortion rates in the state of Wisconsin, what does that say to you?
Well, I think we have to take a really serious look at what the research out there shows. And what research shows is that when unintended pregnancy rates drop, abortion rates drop. The thing that makes unintended pregnancy rates drop is better access to contraceptives, better usage of people of contraceptives, and really having more effective contraceptives. So while the whole litany of abortion restrictions that have been passed in the last few years do have an impact on the ability of providers to offer abortion services and do have an impact on the patient experience, the real reason that abortion numbers decline and have declined as contraceptive access has gotten better is because women are having fewer unintended pregnancies.
Well, we do have, in effect, the Affordable Care Act that's been active for about 5 years now. Chelsea, is it possible that more women in Wisconsin, for instance, are covered under that law and may have increased access to birth control, leading to a drop in abortion rates?
Well, I would say a 10% decrease in 1 year is pretty significant just to attribute to a decrease in unintended pregnancies alone. And if we look at these numbers, this is one full year after Sonia's law was put into effect. That's one full year of women having a better opportunity to see their unborn children, you know, on an ultrasound. So to see that much of a significant decrease, I don't think we can contribute that to that one factor alone.
And Nicole, let's speak to that ultrasound law that Chelsea just referenced there. Do you think you could ascribe what we're seeing here in these numbers to that law, largely, maybe not in its entirety, but in a large part?
You know, I don't think that law had any impact on the rate, the reduction in the abortion rate in Wisconsin. At least at Planned Parenthood, we already were providing ultrasounds for all of our patients that were obtaining an abortion because that's the standard of care. So the law, while the law changed the tone of what we have to do because now we have the state of Wisconsin inserting itself into what the standard of care should be in abortion care, it didn't actually change in practice. So I think that is a really false connection.
And Chelsea, what would you say to that? Nicole says that is a false connection, that the ultrasound was standard in care, and she doesn't see it having that big an effect. What do you say to that?
Well, the difference with Sonia's law was the fact that women were informed of the opportunity to see that ultrasound, and that's something that wasn't standard practice beforehand. And that's where we're seeing these significant changes here. And we've heard story after story from many women around the state who had that opportunity to see their unborn child, and now having that information that humanizes their unborn child, that may help them make the decision to choose life.
And we're talking right now about the 10% drop in abortions performed in Wisconsin in 2014. This is part of a six-year downward trend. And joining us are Chelsea Shields, the Legislative PAC Director of Wisconsin Right to Life, and Nicole Safar, Government Relations Director for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin. And Chelsea, I want to ask you a little bit more about the Affordable Care Act. Now, you don't think that access to birth control is the reason for the decline in numbers, but do you see maybe the Affordable Care Act, maybe increased access to birth control having an impact?
Well, I think there are a lot of different factors that go into, you know, why women choose abortion and why women choose life. And what I think here, though, is as we're seeing these declines in abortion rates around the country, these do coincide with the passage of many pieces of right to life legislation. And just the fact that since 1973, since the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision, so many advances in science have been made when it comes to ultrasound technology and what we know about unborn life, that I think that's played a huge part in the changes that we've seen in the abortion rate as it's falling.
And Nicole, what do you have to say to that? The advances in science and what we know about the baby or the development there of the fetus, however you want to put it, does that impact the numbers state to state?
Well, I think that Chelsea is right in saying that there are a whole host of factors that women take into consideration when they are determining whether to have a child or end a pregnancy. What Planned Parenthood is really focused on and what our mission is to help women prevent unintended pregnancies. That's what we do every day. That's actually what the Affordable Care Act, one of the biggest pieces of the Affordable Care Act that has a very positive impact on women's health across the country is the affordable access to birth control. And preventing unintended pregnancies really helps to make it so women don't find themselves in a situation where they might be facing an unintended pregnancy. Having healthy, planned pregnancies is what we're all about at Planned Parenthood. And I think that, again, the research, decades of research shows that better access to better contraception results in lower unintended pregnancy rates and lower abortion rates.
So, Nicole, then with that definition in mind, would you say that Planned Parenthood is doing its job? It's preventing unintended pregnancies, and that's why these numbers are falling.
Absolutely. I think that we work very hard to give women and families the tools that they need to plan healthy pregnancies at a time that is right for each individual family. And I think when we can get better at that and we can make sure that every woman who is having a pregnancy is having a planned pregnancy, abortion rates are going to drop.
And are they dropping beyond Wisconsin, Chelsea, that you know of? Are abortion rates down nationwide?
Yes. So nationwide, there's been a steady decrease in the abortion numbers. Now, obviously, that would vary from state to state, and we're very fortunate here in Wisconsin that we've had a very steady drop all the way through. But nationwide, we've seen a significant decrease.
And so you've got a mix of laws in different states. You have Planned Parenthood, Nicole, operating in all 50 states?
Yes.
So then looking at that bigger trend where you have both, do you still stand by what you've said so far?
Of course. I think one of the things we haven't got to touch on yet, which is a huge reason why unintended pregnancy rates have dropped, are contraceptives called long-acting reversible contraceptives, and those are the IUDs and IUCs. That method has been steadily increasing, and we've seen a lot of really exciting research coming out of states like Colorado and Missouri, where women have access to these longer-acting contraceptives that don't rely on taking a pill every day and that are just so much more effective. And we are seeing significant drops in unintended pregnancy rates because of those methods. We're seeing significant drops among younger women when they choose a more effective method. And I just really think the research tells such an exciting story that we are on the right track and that we can continue to make a dent in these unintended pregnancy rates, because when you look at the country, they absolutely are dropping, but the U.S. still has one of the highest rates of unintended pregnancy in the world, so we do have work to do still.
And Chelsea, Nicole mentioned long-acting reversal contraceptives. Is your group, Wisconsin Right to Life, seeing an impact, do you think, from that?
Well, our focus has always been to make sure we're empowering women with the most information possible about the reality of abortion and the humanity of her unborn child. So that's been our focus, and we've been very glad with the results that we've seen with women empowered with information and then choosing life.
We're talking right now about the 10% drop in abortions performed in Wisconsin in 2014. It's part of a six-year downward trend. Joining us, Chelsea Shields, the Legislative PAC Director of Wisconsin Right to Life, and Nicole Safar, Government Relations Director for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin.
And you can join the conversation, too, at 800-642-1234. How do you explain this decline in the number of abortions in Wisconsin, a 10%, as we mentioned, over the last year, part of that six-year downward trend? What is leading to that? Laws making it harder to get abortions, giving more information to women seeking them, or is it access to contraception, or do you have another explanation or a question for one of our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the 10% drop in abortions performed in Wisconsin in the year 2014. It's part of a six-year downward trend. Wisconsin recently put a law into place banning abortions after 20 weeks with no exceptions for rape and incest, and a law requiring women to get an ultrasound before an abortion is also on the books as of 2013. Joining us, Chelsea Shields, Legislative PAC Director of Wisconsin Right to Life, and Nicole Safar, Government Relations Director for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Are laws restricting abortions the reason for that drop, or is it in part because women have more access to contraceptives? How do you explain this trend? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Nicole, I want to ask you about some social structures that have been in flux over the last couple of decades. It used to be frowned upon for women to have babies out of wedlock, and now we're seeing a change in social mores, given that in this case in Wisconsin, 77% of Wisconsin residents' abortions were obtained by women who had never been married. Could part of the drop in abortions mean that women might opt to have babies out of wedlock now more than they used to?
Well, Veronica, I think we have to be careful when we sort of conflate different statistics together and make conclusions like that. I don't think anyone would dispute the fact that there just are more unmarried women now than there were 20 years ago. A lot of women are delaying marriage for whatever reason or deciding not to get married. And not all of those women are delaying motherhood. So, you know, I think that you have to maybe be someone with a little bit more scientific research in front of them than I have right now to make that conclusion. But again, we really are, when we make sure that women have the tools to plan their pregnancies, whether they're married or not, that's for each individual to decide, you know, what's right for them. But being able to plan a healthy pregnancy is really where Planned Parenthood comes into it, and helping women have the tools to avoid it when they're not ready to be a mother, and helping them get enrolled in programs and prenatal care when they are ready to. That's what we're focusing on.
And Chelsea, do you want to weigh in on that before we go to the calls?
I think regardless of the circumstances of, you know, a mother considering abortion or choosing life is a brave decision, and that's what we really focus on, is empowering a woman in any circumstances to have all the resources that she needs to choose life.
Let's go to our callers. Krista joins us first in Appleton. Krista, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, I wanted to say, I think another part of the puzzle that we're missing that's really helping is the overall turn in economy, making it easier for mothers not only to have this baby and through the help of things like the Affordable Care Act, but to keep the baby once they have it. I also wanted to say that I think, you know, Planned Parenthood is doing an excellent job of trying to provide solutions by helping get, you know, birth control and more information out there. I wish the pro-life side, which I don't like those terms because I don't think anyone's against life and I don't think anyone's against choice. I feel those are rather silly, but, you know, they just say no, whereas I think they could be doing more, like helping make adoption seem like a less evil option, you know, or helping women get to places where they can safely get through these pregnancies, you know. I think there's other solutions, because the fact of the matter is just because you can get pregnant doesn't mean you're able to keep or take care of that baby, and I think that's something that needs to be taken into consideration and worked for.
Krista, thank you for the call. And Chelsea, first of all, what about the economy? And then to the second point of Krista's calls about promoting adoption, for instance.
Well, I would challenge anybody to find a pro-lifer who isn't a fan of adoption. And this is why organizations like Wisconsin Right to Life, we work so hard to support pregnancy centers all around the state who have excellent connections with a variety of adoption agencies. And they're in the best position to help walk with women in their decision to choose life and making the decision of whether to parent or place their child for adoption. And, you know, that's really our focus, is what can we do to help support the women, empower her with all the information that she needs while bravely deciding to choose life for her child.
And Nicole, any comments?
Well, I just wanted to thank the caller for her comments. And, you know, I think that listeners can really see a pretty stark difference in the perspective that Chelsea and Wisconsin Right to Life bring to the discussion and that Planned Parenthood brings to the discussion, in that at Planned Parenthood we're really all about on the prevention side and making sure that we can plan healthy planned pregnancies with women. And Wisconsin Right to Life and the politicians they support are just singularly focused on what happens once you have an unintended pregnancy and trying to dissuade abortion. So it's a very different approach. I'm really proud of the approach Planned Parenthood takes and all of the good work we do in communities across the state.
Abortion rates in Wisconsin are down right now, 10% in 2014. This is part of a six-year trend. We're talking about that right now with Chelsea Shields, Legislative PAC Director of Wisconsin Right to Life, and Nicole Safar, Government Relations Director for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin. And we'll go back to our phones at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a comment on this, are laws restricting abortion the reason for this drop, do you think, or do women have more access to contraceptives? 800-642-1234. And we'll go to Richard next in Eau Claire. Richard, hi.
Yes, thank you for the conversation and the subject. And I think what was missing so far from this whole conversation is the word abstinence. I think that is the one and really the truest way to stop so-called unintended pregnancies. You know, the whole fact that there is a life in that womb is a gift. It's a gift from God, the Creator, and He makes it very clear. And I think education now has gone through so many generations that we educate our children to have fun and have sex, as opposed to letting them know that there are unintended consequences when you have sex out of marriage or in marriage, even after you've raised so many families.
Richard, thank you for the call. And Nicole, should abstinence have a part in this conversation?
You know, I want to thank Richard for bringing this up and for sharing his thoughts on this. I've heard other people say very similar things over the years, and absolutely, when we are talking about comprehensive, responsible sex education for young people, abstinence is a critical part of the discussion. It's critical that young people learn the skills to deal with difficult situations that they might find themselves in. It's critical that young people learn the skills to say no and to understand the consequences. And it is a big part of what we do at Planned Parenthood in our education department is teach those skills. We also work very closely with parents of young people to help them engage in these difficult conversations with their teens.
And Chelsea, just very briefly, we're short of time here. What are you looking for next when it comes to legislation about abortion in Wisconsin?
Well, overall, Wisconsin Right to Life, we refuse to choose between a mother and child, and we're going to continue to work to pass pro-life legislation that makes sure that no woman ever has to make a decision that both hurts herself and her unborn child. And in the future, we hope to continue to work on many more pieces of Right to Life legislation to inform women and help them save their children.
And Nicole, what about you? Planned Parenthood, what are you looking for next as a next step?
Well, you know, as the state's oldest and largest reproductive health provider, celebrating 80 years this year in Wisconsin, taking care of patients all across the state, what I'm really hoping is that Wisconsin Right to Life would take its focus out of trying to take funding and critical access points away from women who are just trying to get birth control, just trying to get cervical cancer screenings in Wisconsin, and keep their politics to themselves and continue to fight
and
their political battles.
We have to leave it there. Chelsea and Nicole, thank you so much for joining us. That was Chelsea Shields, Legislative PAC Director of Wisconsin Right to Life, and Nicole Safar, Government Relations Director for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin.
Last night saw Stephen Colbert step into the well-worn shoes of late-night talk show host David Letterman. There have been some questions. Could Colbert leave behind the persona he used for his political satire, the Colbert Report?
With this show, as many people have asked, with this show, I begin the search for the real Stephen Colbert. I just hope I don't find him on Ashley Madison.
Well, now we know what the new Stephen Colbert is going to be like. He's going to be a funny guy hosting a late-night talk show. Colbert took just about his whole team from Comedy Central along for the ride to The Late Show, and here's a taste from his first night.
I started college the same year Dave started in late night, and not having the fullest social calendar, I was frequently available for Dave at 12:30.
I somehow, I was a kid when David Letterman started. I somehow managed to be up late watching the show, I assume on weekends when my bedtime was a little more lax. You watched Letterman too, right?
I watched Letterman too and Conan O'Brien. It's just interesting that there's this whole changing of the guard of late night. It's I guess, a sign that we're getting older.
Yeah, I'll probably end up seeing more Colbert in clips on the internet than actually watching the show. And I don't know, I still, since we started Central Time, wanted to go back to the early Letterman tradition of the elevator races. So can
elevator
we,
races.
Yeah, they used to do that early on where they'd, in their big, whatever, Rockefeller Center, race elevators up and down. We've got three elevators here at Vilas.
I don't think anyone's winning any races in those
elevators. Yeah, we'd get stuck probably. Well, stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.